You can get the latest odds, offers and more great content at williamhill.com, on the William Hill app and in any of our shops around the UK. The Daily Racing Podcast from William Hill.
And they're off.
Listen to the podcast at williamhill.com/podcast.
Third festival win and the biggest one today.
Or subscribe via iTunes by searching William Hill Podcasts in the music store.
Hello and a very warm welcome along to the Daily Racing Podcast brought to you by William Hill. You join us on Monday's edition of the podcast, looking ahead to the action at Brighton on this edition. Sam Norris here, joined by Rory DeLaghi. We'll be having a little look back at some of Saturday's star performers as well. But first things first, welcome along, Rory. How are you?
I am very well, thanks.
Good. Good stuff. It was a cracking Saturday yesterday, of course, Rory. We were both in the studio watching the action. Let's look back at some of the highlights. We've got to start with Harry Angel, really, because that was a superb victory in the Haydock Sprint Cup on ground that, as we know, wouldn't have been ideal for the horse, but he handled it really well and blitzed his rivals. It was almost more impressive than the July Cup victory, even though Caravaggio and Limato weren't there. I sort of found it more impressive given the underfoot conditions yesterday.
Yeah, forget the underfoot conditions for the time being. It was a better performance,
yes,
than the July Cup. July Cup was a messy race. Various horses weren't seen to best effect the way that was run, and strictly speaking, it'd be difficult to describe that as Harry Angel's best performance, yeah, other than the fact that it came in a big Group 1 race. Yesterday he got his chance to dominate his rivals again, where they had no excuses, and he was devastating, quite frankly. The ground was talked up all week as the major issue in the race. And there was a lot of talk about Brando,
yes,
coming into it. And really, there was no evidence to suggest that Brando would be any better on the ground than Harry Angel was beforehand. He had a couple of wins on soft ground early in his career. But one of those was a handicap of a mark in the 80s. So he's not,
yes,
he's not a horse who had been winning Group 1s on soft ground against a horse who needed fast ground. And the only time Harry Angel had met soft ground previously, he'd been a very impressive winner. And that was on ground that wasn't as bad as Haydock.
Yeah.
But it was good to soft at Newbury. And Newbury going, you know, what we've seen in the last year or so, can get pretty testing there. So it's just a case of him meeting fast ground this season, because the races that had been planned out from the start of the season happened to coincide with quick ground.
Yes.
And people simply made the assumption that he's a fast ground horse. If there were 20 Group 1s for 6 furlong horses through the season, then Clive Cox might have picked a different set of races.
Yeah.
And if he was clearly picking races that would find the right conditions for him, then, yeah, you could maybe make that conclusion. But it wasn't the case. He handles any ground. He's just a devastatingly good sprinter. He pulled hard again. I thought he settled pretty well at Newmarket. But he wanted to go much faster than Adam Kirby wanted to let him early on yesterday. But when he asked him, he didn't just keep going well enough to hold the others off. He quickened 2 furlongs out, despite having raced freely. And the rest of them were floundering immediately after that. He's head and shoulders above that crop of sprinters at the moment. And there's some half-decent horses in there. Obviously, the 5 furlong horses,
yes,
are arguably a better bunch this year. But you know, the second and third, I think, were the second and third best horses pre-race, and they just underlined the value of the form.
Very fair points. Across the Irish Sea, then, we saw favourites tumbling, i.e. 2 Ballydoyle Hotpots in the shape of Churchill and Winter both being defeated. We'll start with Winter, who didn't really lose a great deal in defeat at all. She was game, she battled hard, she has had a long season now and was eventually beaten by Hydrangea, but I didn't feel that it really detracts from her season for me. I thought she was still not at the top of her game yesterday. Aidan O'Brien expected that she perhaps wouldn't be, but it was still a very good performance, I think, to finish.
Yeah, I thought, and she showed real guts as well in getting beaten.
Yeah.
Briefly, she looked like she was going to win. She travelled quite well in behind the leaders. Ryan Moore was keen not to give her a hard race, knowing that she'd missed work and wasn't 100%. And obviously, if you can get them to win in the bridle in that scenario, that's much better than giving them a very hard race. She then looked like she's going to be swamped by the filly to finish first, third and fourth. But she's battled back to get the better of Persuasive for second, and just found Hydrangea too strong. And Hydrangea on her day is very good. She's not been the easiest to predict.
Yeah.
But she was an absolutely top-notch two-year-old last season. And she's always had this kind of performance in her. What Winter did last time and earlier in the season still makes her the best filly in the race. And hopefully we'll get to see her back to her best before the end of the season. It's never easy to keep a three-year-old at the top of their game through the autumn, having peaked for the guineas.
Yes.
Especially if you go both English and Irish guineas. And very few fillies have actually done both. Very, very few historically. So we should tip our hats to Winter. She's been an absolute star this season, and hopefully she can cap her season with another big win.
Yes, absolutely. And one horse who also completed the Guineas double over the season, but it's just beginning to look a little bit over the top now, is Churchill, who was beaten by Decorated Knight.
Yeah, it's been talked up as a massive shock, but Decorated Knight has proved himself to be a top-notch performer this season.
Yep.
Yes, he's been beaten in a couple of Group 1s, but he's also won Group 1s. He was obviously winner of the Tattersall's Gold Cup at the Curragh earlier in the season. He had excuses for finishing behind Churchill last time in the international at York. He pulled muscles and back to his best. He was entitled to be thereabouts. You know, in terms of the official ratings, in terms of time form ratings, whatever way you want to look at it, he only had 1 or 2 pounds to find. And he's run his race. He was suited by the way it was run. Eminent was always going to make the running because he improved last time for being allowed to do that. Everyone knew he was going to try to do that. So a couple of his main dangers were keen not to let him go, and they went that little bit too fast, I think, in the middle part of the race. I don't think they set off too fast. But they were always pressing Eminent, and Frankie wanted to go for home off the home turn. And that was probably too early to kick in retrospect. And most of the field were tracking him and went with him. And it was the two who were right at the back of the field with a furlong and a half to run, who came through to finish first and second. And they came with the runs down the outside of the field, which has been beneficial at Leopardstown in these conditions before. And yes, they were definitely helped, Decorated Knight and Poet's Word. And Eminent comes out of the race arguably as the best horse there, given that he almost certainly did too much in front, and yet he beat all those rivals who were chasing him throughout. But you have to take your hat off to Connections of Decorated Knight, who've been very bold this season. They haven't missed a dance all year.
Yeah.
Roger Charlton is an exceptional trainer, always has been, and he deserves all the big races that come his way.
Good stuff. That's yesterday's action taken care of then. We're going to continue on with our feature series next of all, and just pick Rory's brain for a few minutes on racing journalism, I suppose. It's something that we get a lot of emails in about, Rory, people asking what is the best way in. You and I are in a very privileged position that we get paid to talk about horse racing. Where did it all start for you?
It's always a slightly convoluted business, really. It's never straightforward, because lots of people want to get into this game.
Yes.
And sort of banging on the door doesn't work for many people. And indeed didn't work for me. The first way I tried to get into this side of the business was through the now defunct Timeform Radio, and I knew who was in charge there, and I emailed and I said I'd be interested in getting involved, and I knew that potentially there was a position there on a rota for freelancers. I got no response, and I found the best way of getting in was just making myself visible. I ended up I took my sister's father-in-law racing at Haydock. He lived around the corner, and I met some people from Betfair. We had lunch in the box there, in which a lot of Betfair people were around. It was Betfair Chase Day, great day out. I got talking to people. I then went to the Derby Awards off my own back. Bought myself a ticket. I had a friend who had a table, but it was one of a case of get yourself a black tie and turn up for this event. Again, it's an awards ceremony for the for racing journalists, the Horse Race Writers and Photographers Association, sponsored by, hosted by Lord Derby or whatever it happens to be. And that's always a good do. And there's always guaranteed a punch up afterwards as well, which everyone loves. I went along to that, and I knew a few people anyway. I'd worked in the betting industry before, so I knew people on that side of things, but I'd never sort of touched the journalism side. I was then talking about how I'd love to get into the business with people I'd met at Haydock, and someone just said, "Hold on a second, I'll phone that bloke that you've been emailing and not getting a response from and get him round the pub." Okay. So one phone call, the bloke turns up in the pub, and you may not, a lot of people don't want to answer emails from people saying, "Oh, I want to be a journalist," because they're getting 50 of them a day. But you speak to someone face to face,
yes,
and it's just a case of, well, okay, well, why don't you come in a day next week, next month, and, you know, we'll put you on with somebody else as a second pundit and see how that works out. And that was it. I did a couple of days the following month. It worked quite well. And then I just kept doing bits and pieces there. And from that, you get a little bit more exposure and other things crop up. But you've got to keep pressing. If all you're doing is occasionally saying on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever, "Oh, I'd love to get into the business," or just, you know, emailing the wrong people or even the right people,
yes,
without becoming visible, then it's very difficult to break into it. You have to take a chance, really. It is a pretty random business, but networking works.
Yes.
I know we're in kind of a post-networking age, but it's a very old-fashioned industry.
Right.
And therefore, actually meeting people, getting people to realize that, first of all, you're not just desperate for a job, because people don't like,
yes,
you know, spending 2 hours in the company of someone who's saying, "Giz a job," like yours or yous. So if people like you, think you know what you're talking about, reckon that you've got the right attitude, the right personality, then you've got a chance of getting there. And you just got to gently push doors when that's appropriate, and know when not to push. It's tough. Yeah. It's tough, and there are better people than me who've never got into it. But if you don't find the opportunities, then you won't find those doors that will open for you. And there are plenty of locked doors, but there are open doors there. But if you get yourself out in front of those doors, then it gives you a chance of getting on. That's not a great answer. There is no system for getting involved.
Yes.
You just have to have the chutzpah to do it. And there are one or two people out there who've made a name for themselves. Not mentioning any names here, but if you're a Twitter user, you're probably aware of at least one person who has made a big splash just by being
relentless. Yeah.
And that works.
Yeah.
You know, it annoys a lot of people, but the people who it doesn't annoy think, "That's cool. I could use that." So don't do it like that, but be aware that,
yes,
being persistent works as long as you've got something to offer. You've got to show that you've got something to offer, and you just got to pray that you get the right opportunity, you get the time to talk to the right person at the right time.
Much like Decorated Knights, if you turn up at every dance, you might eventually reap the rewards.
Yeah,
at the
exactly.
End of it.
Absolutely.
You obviously write for the Irish Field and do a little bit of writing for Hugo Palmer as well. What are the sort of differences there, some of the challenges that you face on a weekly basis? I know sometimes you might be stuck for an idea for your column.
I do two columns for the Irish Field. One is an opinion piece, which I
presumably that one's a little bit easier to find content for.
Yeah, it's not hard finding content. It's just it's hard choosing the right content.
Right.
I find it's a lot easier writing a piece about the weekend's racing. We'd like you to write 1,000 words on Saturday's racing. That's a doddle.
Yes.
Because you've got the structure there.
Yeah,
you've got,
sure,
right, I'll pick 6 races. You stick the race titles in there on your document. You go, right, now I've just got to talk about the race and hopefully find a winner.
Put a bit of meat on the bones.
Yeah, and so the whole idea is there for you on paper. Someone says, write about whatever you like. It terrifies me because it's like, well, you know, there's so much I could do,
yes,
but I've got to pick something, otherwise it doesn't get going. It's almost too organic. So I sort of hum and haw off a lot before doing that. And it would, in some ways, be easier if someone said, "We want you to write a piece, and to be honest, we'd like it to be about this."
Yes.
I don't get asked to do that. I get free rein. And occasionally you're like, "Well, we didn't want you writing about that." But it, as a rule, it goes down fairly well. But yeah, I find it more difficult when I'm given carte blanche to do something, because you've got to get an idea down on paper before you can start writing about it. And I often wait until the last minute before I get started with that, which works for me, but it's not everyone's cup of tea. I find that lighting a fire under my backside, panic helps me distill my thoughts a lot easier. I was asked to write a book at one stage, and that's just absolutely pointless. Like, oh, you got 4 months to write it. It's like, yeah, I'm not going to start for 3.5 months, so I don't think that's going to work. So that's part of my work. It doesn't pay brilliantly, and that's something to bear in mind if you want to get into the business. You know, you think, oh, I write 2 pieces for a newspaper. Crikey, you must be loaded. Well, not really. If you're getting paid more than 5p a word to write for anyone, you're doing reasonably well. And it doesn't earn a huge amount of money. You go, oh, I'll write 3,000 words.
Sounds horrible when you put it like that.
Nobody wants 3,000 words either.
Right.
People want reasonably short copy. You know, no more than 1,000 generally for a piece. So therefore, you know, getting paid more than 50 quid for any piece of work in print or on the internet is you know, par for the course. So if you think you can make a living out of it, but you've only got a couple of pieces a week in you, then you're not going to make a great living. You've got to push yourself a little harder than that. The blog I do for Hugo Palmer, again, I was approached out of the blue to do that. And again, it's, you know, I've organically picked up work because I'm doing something else, and
yes,
people are aware of me. And I'm as a journalist, I have a press accreditation for Cheltenham. I don't tend to do all the tracks. I may do a little, now that I've moved to Surrey. In the southeast, there's an awful lot more race courses, so I may get out there a lot more. But you know, I was always in the press room at Cheltenham and in the paddock at Cheltenham with the previous job as well. I worked on Cheltenham Radio in the old days, and you get to know people through that. And occasionally, people will say, "I'm looking for someone to do this. Would you be interested?" And sometimes you don't have the time for that, and sometimes you do, and sometimes no one asks you that.
Yes.
But if you're not there, if you're not uppermost in people's minds, you don't get asked those questions. Mm. So I was very surprised when I was asked to do the Hugo Palmer column. But I really enjoy that.
Yep.
And it suits me ideally, because I'm not having to think what content to put in there.
Yep.
I'll phone Hugo up. He's a busy man. I will say, there's not an awful lot of small talk in there. I'll say, right, you okay to talk? Yeah, fine. Here's 4 horses running tomorrow. What do you think? And he will say in his own words what he thinks of those horses' chances. I'll scribble it down in shorthand. If you can actually do shorthand, you will get yourself a job as a racing journalist. Not very many can these days. And I don't do real I do my own shorthand. But I've got a very good memory. So I find that I will speak to him, I record it, and I write it down as well. And then I find that when I start writing it, I often don't need to look at what I've written down or what I've recorded.
Yeah.
The process of doing it means that it's uppermost in my mind. And then what I'll do is I'll go back and make sure that I haven't said something that I've interpreted differently. And I'll send it to him straight away so that he can say, I don't want to say that. That's not exactly what I said. And or I might have said that, but now that I read it back, it sounds wrong. And I find very quickly that I think the first column I did, he phoned me up and said, I want you to change this, I want you to change this. And then the next one I did, he said, that's fine, and it's been fine since. So that's very gratifying. That's decent work. That probably pays better than anything else I have, really, in that there's a lot of pieces in there, 2-3 a week maybe, which covers weekend racing and any major festivals. And other bits and pieces, and it's nice to have something as regular as that.
Mm.
If I can get something for the jump season as well, I'll be very happy. That hasn't happened yet, but I'll try to make myself reasonably visible, and hopefully Hugo will say he's happy with what I've done, which helps get other stuff. And, you know, you've always got to be finding new stuff, because about 3 or 4 years ago, just before I started at William Hill Radio, I lost every piece of work I had.
Right.
Obviously, Timeform Radio was wound up with about 10 minutes notice, which was not the greatest thing. Although I'd left shortly before that, but the people who were left, they cut it down to a skeleton staff, and they were doing they were keeping going every day, and then they were told one day, this is it. Once you finish today, you know, pack your bags and go, which was, you know, the people who really depended on that for their livelihood. And I also, I did a lot of short comment writing for Timeform as a freelancer, and that's, they started automating a lot of their stuff. so they needed less people.
Yep.
And they used in-house people only, so all the freelancers got let go essentially there. And that was my, it was about a week before my son was born, and a week before the Cheltenham Festival. And suddenly I had absolutely no work.
Right.
The fact that it was the Cheltenham Festival was a massive blessing in disguise, because I met two people at Cheltenham who offered me work. And I was straight back on the horse within a month. But you need to have, I made the mistake of not having backup options.
Yes.
And I was lucky to pick something up. So you can't assume that something you have is going to keep you going for the next 5 years. Things can change very quickly, particularly in an internet-driven world.
Mm. Oh, good stuff. Thanks for that, Rory. We mustn't forget Monday's racing as well. Got a couple of races that we'll be giving the preview treatment to on Monday, and two at Brighton. We begin with the 4:55 Classics Handicap over 7 furlongs. Here, as we know, Rory, given the quirky nature of the track generally at Brighton, it pays to be with course specialists. There aren't all that many in this race, though.
No, but the one thing I like about Brighton, every time I see a Brighton meeting, I don't really like punting at Brighton as a rule. You get lots of trouble in running. But I love a big field mile handicap. And one aspect of this I like is the notion that as a tightish left-handed track, people tend to look for horses who are drawn low. Over a mile at Brighton, the track is shaped almost like an M, and the mile start has a sweeping right-handed turn before they turn into the straight. So the horses who are able to get to the front are usually those drawn high. So I like to look for horses who have a chance on form in the first place, but are drawn reasonably high and like to go forward. And I particularly like it when there's a bit of dig in the ground in the hope that they stay near side as well, which means that you can give any advantage you gain away by going across to the inside rail too quickly, and then other horses come on top of you, and it's easy to sort of, with the camber there, to get caught in the rail. So I like horses who will stay wide. So I look for horses who fit the bill, and I look for jockeys who I think are tactically astute enough to ride to their draw and stay middle to near side. And tomorrow we have two pretty moderate races at Brighton, but a couple of horses that I like the look of. Starting in the 4:55 with Luxford, who's a pretty obvious one, is liable to be favourite for this mile handicap, but not a short price. It looks an open race. Luxford is a dual course and distance winner this season. Both his wins have come when ridden by Martin Dwyer. Last time he won, Martin Dwyer jumped him out handily, led or disputed the lead early, stayed middle to stand side, and won narrowly. He went up £4 and was beaten at Sandown next time out under a £7 claimer. Happy to ignore that run. Also beaten under the same claimer in his previous start. Back at Brighton, with Martin Dwyer back on board and drawn in stall 12 in a big field, I think he's perfectly positioned to do what he did last time out. And although there are 14 runners here, there are about 5 or 6 you can put a line through straight away. It doesn't look that competitive. There are plenty you can give half a chance to in there, but one or two that I like are drawn low, which I think is a negative. Garth Rocket, for example, who won last time out, has drawn stall 1. I think that's very hard to overcome. And the one I put up as a danger is a horse called Buskin River, trained by James Eustace, who was second on his final start for Richard Hannon last season. Been well beaten in 2 runs for James Eustace, but they came both after a significant break, and he's now having his second run within a month. Looked like he needed it at Nottingham last time out, having travelled well. I think he's the danger, and I think he's the one also who's going to put pace pressure on Luxford, so I might just have a saver on him, but Luxford looks the best bet there.
Luxford in the 4:55 at Brighton then, and finally we come to the next race on the card at Brighton, and indeed the final race on the card there on Monday, and it's the 5:25, which is an apprentice handicap, again over the same trip, just shy of a mile. What about this race then, Rory? Same tactics applied to the previous?
Yeah, one? Roughly. I mean, the horse who's most likely to lead here is dear old Megalala, yeah. And I would absolutely love it if he won. 16 years old now, and clearly not the force of old. Can't fall any further down the handicap. The lowest you can go really is 46. And he's been well beaten this year. He could bounce back, and it would be lovely to see the 16-year-old win, because No one can remember the last 16-year-old to win races on the flat. But the horse I'm interested in here is World Record, who is a course specialist, tends to run his best races at Brighton, is a course and distance winner. He's been in and out this season. He ran badly at Yarmouth in his penultimate start, but he did well last time. He was beaten 3¾ lengths, but he was beaten by a horse called Arctic Flower, who was winning her fourth consecutive race. And he pulled clear of the others in that handicap at Lingfield on softish ground. Gets similar grounds tomorrow, handles it heavy. And he was a creditable second over course and distance in May on the start before Yarmouth. That form hasn't worked out brilliantly, but it just again showed that he's in reasonable form. He's a pound lower for that. I'm not sure he's entirely trustworthy. He's probably more likely to be placed than win, but I think he's almost certain to hit the frame here. So if he's an each-way price, I will be backing him each way. There aren't too many who jump off the page in this contest. Papu Tony could outclass them if he can show the form that he shows at Kempton, but he is a much better horse on polytrack than he is on turf, and he was only third of five over course and distance last time out, and that form isn't good enough to win this, so he needs to step up. And on balance, I think that World Record looks a safer bet.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks for that, Rory. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon on the Daily Racing Podcast.
William Hill is committed to responsible gambling. Visit gambleaware.co.uk for more information.